You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
Good evening, Shane. This is Rod Adams coming to you tonight from Pensacola, Florida.
Evening, Rod. This is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Angeles, New Mexico, and this is The Atomic Show, episode number 9.
Yeah, I hope that you don't mind me throwing in an extra episode there. I found an old interview and threw it up as show number 8. I think it's a valuable little piece of audio that provides a viewpoint about the atomic / nuclear industry that many people may not be familiar with.
Well, when I first heard the interview, I was hurtling west across the plains of Oklahoma, just outside of Oklahoma City, and it's kind of amusing that I was listening to it at the same time as we were going past a 20-mile stretch of interstate that was surrounded on both sides by a huge wind farm. And I was thinking about the number of employees who must be employed by that wind farm and the subsidies they're on. But Kelly was an interesting interview, definitely.
Good. Well, let's see. There's been an awful lot of new news about nations that are announcing that basically nuclear is their future, or at least they're going to put a significant effort back into building new nuclear power plants. Perhaps not to the exclusion of others, but certainly included in the mix.
Well, that's cool. What nations have cropped up this week?
Well, we've talked a little bit about Russia in the past, but India and China continue to be very interested. South Africa, in addition to their pebble bed modular reactors, has announced that they are interested in adding another large pressurized water reactor at their Coburg plant in South Africa. And Canada has started some interesting discussions in the last couple of weeks with regard to their new nuclear power plants, specifically talking about the possibility of buying plants from either the United States or France, to the vast irritation of Atomic Energy of Canada Limited.
IACL. It's interesting that just a couple of years ago, the tables were turned and the AECL was talking with the NRC in the United States about what it would take to license their CANDU technology, which is incidentally a acronym for Canadian Can Deuterium B Uranium U. And as I recall, one of the reservations that the American NRC had about it was that, and Jeremy Whitlock has spoken about this at length on the Canadian Nuclear Fact, that CANDU plants filled with natural uranium have a slightly positive void coefficient of reactivity. And that was something of a no-no by NRC standards, or maybe I'm oversimplifying things a bit.
Well, that's true about the first and second generation CANDUs, but I believe that the advanced CANDUs, the ACR reactors, use slightly enriched uranium that avoids that positive void coefficient. And if I'm not mistaken,
drives it slightly negative.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, and matter of fact, I know I'm not mistaken in this case, Dominion Resources or Dominion Power, which that company often changes its name, but was very interested in the ACR, and they initially thought that that was going to be what they would build at their Lake Anna site for another plant. They have two plants there right now. And one of the things that really turned Dominion away from the CANDU or the ACR was the fact that the NRC told them that it would take about 2 years longer to license that reactor compared to licensing a pressurized water reactor, mainly because the NRC is much less familiar with the technology and would have a longer licensing phase for that reactor.
And that's interesting to know that, as far as I remember, CANDU's is just a CANDU reactor is just, it's in many respects similar to an American reactor. It's in that it uses pressurized water, pressurized to a very high pressure to keep it from boiling to cool the core, and then transfers it through a heat exchanger to boil some water that runs through a turbine. So it's very similar to a pressurized water reactor in that respect, but there are the similarities in. For one, it's turned on its side. For two, number two, it continuously refuels. And the refueling machines are kind of cool. There's pictures of them all over the web. I can imagine that the NRC could look at the paperwork that was necessary and come up with that figure of extra 2 years pretty easily.
Yep. And, of course, you know, not having any CANDU specialists in the U.S. Would probably add a little bit to that, although we certainly could bring some across the border. Plenty of Canadians working in the U.S. now.
This is true. So whatever happened to the Carim reactor in Argentina? I remember reading an article that you wrote a few years ago about it, and it seemed like it was a very small 27 megawatt electric pressurized water reactor that they were looking at. And at the time, it was just the interest in nuclear was just barely reawakening. But I hadn't heard anything about it since.
That's a good question. And let's see what Google has to say about the Carim reactor, an innovative small PWR based in Patagonia. Let's see. I'm pulling up the page now. As a matter of fact, the article that showed up first on the list was mine back in June 2001. Let's see if there's anything else.
There's, I think, ivat.net, and they've actually got some pictures now. And apparently the last update was... looks like 2003, so they made some more progress on it, and they didn't really change the design any. But they have a website, and this is something that I don't remember seeing at the time that that your article came out. So that's an improvement. Here you have it, folks: live web browser racing.
I've got it up too, but it's an interesting project. I don't know. Where it's gone. I know that Argentina had some economic problems in the early part of the 21st century, but perhaps with the new interest in nuclear power plants and smaller nuclear power plants, Argentina obviously has some interest and certainly a lot of experience in that field.
It's also interesting that Argentina has one CANDU plant installed there. They have just the one. I think it was their first nuclear power plant, and then they started diversifying to more quote-unquote conventional technology in the sense of being American PWR technology after that.
Yep.
And that may have been what started them down the technical path of looking for smaller and smaller reactors.
I did come across...
Go ahead.
Was going to switch topics to another small reactor project. Came across an article in the Executive Intelligence Review, which some people discount because of the long campaign against the head editor of that. I believe his name is Lyndon LaRouche. But sometimes the articles in that magazine are very, very well written and well researched. And hard to argue with. And this one is about a Texas university called the University of Texas of the Permian Basin, which has signed an agreement on February 22nd with General Atomics to build a between 10 and 25 megawatt thermal reactor that they call the HT3R, pronounced heater. And it's going to be a gas turbine modular helium reactor with the prismatic cores that General Atomics likes as opposed to the pebble beds.
That was the same kind of core that General Atomics used in their demonstration plant at Fort St. Vrain in Colorado, wasn't it?
That's correct. And they've also, been working on a project in Russia to burn plutonium using this same type of technology. Apparently, the university, General Atomics, and Thorium Power have started work on a preconceptual design for the project. It's supposed to take about 6 months to do.
Thorium Power is a fine example of a company that has a lot of vision behind it, and it's been a dream long coming.
Hey, sorry for interrupting. It's Cam here from TPN. I need your help, people. We want to ramp up TPN this year. We got brand new servers and brand new infrastructure and brand new software, and we want to ramp up. We need to add hundreds of shows to TPN this year. If you think you've got what it takes to do a regular show on TPN and you want to work with someone who can help you figure out all the technology and business infrastructure that you need, shoot me an email, cameronreilly@gmail.com. Put the subject heading, I want to be a host. And we'll get back to you. Now, back to your originally scheduled podcast.
Tell us about Thorium Power, Shane.
Thorium Power was started by an engineer by the name of Alvin Radkowski, who actually worked for Admiral Rickover in the United States' Navy nuclear program in the 50s when they were first getting the program started. And he was the chief reactor physics person. And there's actually a great deal of stories about him, and there's a wonderful book out on the internet that you can order from the internet, and it's gone out of print a couple times, but they keep bringing it back because, well, you can't keep a good book down called The Rickover Effect. And so this person got through Rickover's program and engineered a lot of the features of naval nuclear reactor cores, and by all means, Rod, you can jump in to correct me at any time.
I'm going to say is I'm a big fan.
So after he got out of there, he went into private practice and became a college professor for a while. And if you do a search on the U.S. government's patent office site for all the patents by any author by the name of Radkowski, only one name comes back because, well, that name's kind of unique. And all 20-odd of them all are centered around the core technology that Thorium Power eventually was formed to commercialize, which is a seed and blanket way of fueling a conventional nuclear power plant, which incidentally was used as the last core load at the first commercial nuclear power plant to come online in the United States, which was in Shippingport, Pennsylvania, just some distance outside of Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania. And that core went into the reactor, I believe it was 1979, and came out in 1983 and demonstrated in a present-day nuclear reactor, no investment necessary, it demonstrated breathing without liquid sodium involved.
Yes,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that if you search on the term thermal breeder reactor, you might find an interesting article about that power plant. Or light water breeder reactor, that's a good term.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead.
So there was a neat technical exercise that I believe Admiral Rickover himself partially drove, partially motivated in order to bring about in that gentle, persuasive manner that he had with people. And so it was a technical success, but for a long time it seemed like people either ignored it or they had no interest in it because thorium, why do we need thorium? Uranium's, you can't get rid of the stuff fast enough. It's worth nothing. And here we are 20 years later after that last core came out of shipping port and they shut the plant down and turned the plant back to greenfield, the plant site is now a lovely forested area, which I understand is quite clean. And it is in pure United States nuclear regulatory fashion is probably monitored at the atomic level for the slightest spikes of radiation that might possibly come a squirrel who absconded with some material, I don't know. But long story short, I'm Andrew, sorry.
Go ahead.
Greg Kasky started this company called Thorium Power in the late 90s, and he was involved with it for the first 5 years that it was around until he sadly passed away about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, although he was in his late 80s. And the company's premise is simple, is they want to reduce the risk of proliferation of nuclear materials to countries that might do something nefarious with them by making current reactors much more efficient with their fuel and making the resulting products much harder to handle in terms of diversion. And they've definitely gotten an audience from people, from the Russians, for instance. The Russians are very interested in their technology, and as a matter of fact, I believe they're based in Washington. So they've been at it for a few years, and I think they're finally going to get to the point where they can start bearing some technical fruit soon. Well, from what I've been hearing.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the seed and blanket type reactor design. As I've described several times in my writings, the neat thing about that is that it makes sense to me to try to more efficiently burn the nuclear fuel without necessarily needing reprocessing. Simply keep working to consume more and more fuel inside the reactor plant. I want to read you kind of the introduction of that article that I mentioned about the light water breeder, which actually is number one on the Google returns for light water breeder. And it starts off with this. On August 26, 1977, the operators at shipping port began lifting the central modules of the experimental breeder reactor core into the blanket section. The reactor reached criticality. During the next 5 years, the core produced more than 10 billion kilowatt hours of thermal power, equivalent to about 2.5 billion kilowatt hours of electrical power, with a current retail value, this is back in 1995, of approximately $200 million. And it showed no signs of approaching the end of its useful life. It was obvious from the core performance that the reactor was at least a very efficient converter with a long life core. However, in October 1982, the reactor was shut down for the final time under budgetary pressures and a desire to conduct the detailed fuel examination needed to determine if breeding had actually occurred. And when I say budgetary pressures, because the reactor wasn't being able to sell its power for the market value, and the people who were standing by waiting to analyze the fuel were, of course, being paid to sit and wait. And there was no real sign that the experiment would end anytime soon. So they had to end it so that the people could go on and do the analysis work.
So was the performance of the core fuel elements in terms of swelling and other effects of core materials that usually go into a PWR actually better because of the different characteristics of the thorium in the blanket than it would be for a normal core loading? As I understand it, thorium dioxide, which is the material that was used in the blanket, has the highest melting point of any solid found in nature. It melts at over 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's pretty cool.
2,000 degrees hotter than that tungsten. It's not going to melt.
No, and that's it has some very nice characteristics. Anyway, the resulting analysis of the fuel showed that they could have gone for a lot longer. So the experiment was a success, but it was not followed up. I'm encouraged by the fact that people are talking about combining high temperature gas reactors with this type of design, because a gas reactor is even more efficient with neutrons than is a light water reactor, because there is some absorption of neutrons in the oxygen in a light water reactor.
Which is the primary thing that makes the coolant radioactive, although, to be fair, the isotope of oxygen that neutrons turn the oxygen into is only radioactive, has a half-life of like 10 or 12 seconds, so as soon as you turn the reactor off in a couple minutes, you can approach the coolant loops, right?
Yes, that's a nitrogen-16, and not to, you know, correct you or anything, but it is an 8-second half-life, so you know, it's a little bit different than that. But anyway,
close enough for government work.
Well, yeah, that's true. But the, of course, hydrogen does get do some absorption, which is why water that has been through a nuclear reactor has tritium in it, which has been quite a topic on the comment section of the blog associated with the Atomic Show.
Been seeing that. I remember reading in the book about Rickover, the Rickover effect, that Rickover once went before Congress and he had a pitcher of water with him. And as he was giving his remarks, he was just drinking casually from this water. And toward the end of his remarks, he said, "Oh, by the way, gentlemen, the water I've been drinking has been reclaimed from a naval nuclear plant. This water was actually circulating through a full power naval nuclear core."
Yeah,
which is
I wouldn't be worried about it from a health perspective.
Given how closely they monitor the chemistry and all the rules that the nuclear navy operates under.
Now,
I would consider them very competent.
We're competent. I would not drink, even if it was cooled down. I wouldn't drink what comes out of a nuclear reactor core these days, because we add some corrosion inhibitors that are not particularly friendly to drink. But other than that,
much like the stuff I put into my humidifier to keep the hard water from choking it up completely within a month.
Right. Yeah. Chemistry is, you know, it's not nuclear; it's just a chemical thing.
Right. So, for those of you who, those of our listeners who might think that thorium is an exotic material, I have another interesting fact for you. Thorium is possible to buy at Walmart, or really any place where camping supplies are sold. And this is something I've told people, and they don't believe me. Yep, gas mantles for camping lanterns. It turns out that those mantles, when you light them and you do the little drawstring thing and put them onto the reason why they're used is because when they're heated to high temperature, they emit this very nice broad spectrum white light. And like I said before, it's practically impossible to get them to melt because they're made out of, I believe it's a combination of cerium and thorium oxide because they're chemically compatible.
But I can
cerium
tell you,
isn't radioactive.
Yeah. I can tell you
thorium
one thing.
Is, but
I can tell you one thing about those mantles, though. They get the little dome on top of the lantern very hot. I've got a scar on my arm to prove it. I reached across one time to take it off of its hook. Such is life. And we move on. Hey, I just wanted to talk a little bit and kind of join the podcast world a little bit. I want to talk about some of the shows that really have gotten me excited about this whole phenomenon of recording, you know, maybe information you have not yet heard, which is the tagline from one of my favorite podcasts, the Daily Source Code, or let's see, Real Power Can't Be Given, It Must Be Taken, which is another tagline from a podcast called Good Day World, which is one of the inspirations for this podcast, and is the host, the owner of that show is the host of our podcast, the Podcast Network. But I've also been corresponding with a couple of very fascinating ladies who are raising children in Virginia, and they produce a show called The Mommy Cast. And one of the things in life that I've always tried to do, being the father of daughters, is trying to understand as much as possible how people of the opposite sex think. That's a great show for listening to that. So, anyway, those are some of the things that I like to listen to on the podcast world. And since I have such a long commute back and forth to work, I get to listen to lots. Then there's always...
Well, absolutely, and that's it.
It's also Todd Cochran at Geek News Central, and he and I have some similar background from our JOBs, and he also produces a very good show. But this is a neat way to try to share information with people in ways that, you know, some people are better writers than others, and some people are better talkers than others.
It's all in how you feel comfortable expressing yourself, and if you feel stilted by the medium that you're working in, then you're not in the right medium. And I think the closest that ordinary people have ever come before a podcast being able to talk like this over the world was back when ham radio was more popular. Though ham radio has always been kind of an electronics geek hobby, especially with the barriers of entry that they used to have for it. But unfortunately now, ham radio enthusiasts are dying off because it's the elder generation is slowly passing away. And the younger kids are not taking it up because they figure, hey, we've got cell phones, we don't need it. And they serve a purpose. I mean, they provide emergency communications, and they've done so admirably many times in places where other communications methods break down.
Yeah,
that's the nearest thing I can think of.
Yeah, ham radio works when a lot of other things don't. There's an awful lot of places in the world that still don't have cell towers, and I think people have figured out in recent storms that cell phones don't work very well if the cell towers lose power.
Amen to that. And my family in Mississippi can definitely attest to that.
But, you know, I saw something the other day that reminded me that the fascination with this recorded audio media and sending it and distributing it is something that has an old fascination, because what I was watching was an episode of MASH, and Hawkeye Pierce had been given a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he was going around the MASH unit with his microphone in his hand and talking. And he was making a tape to send home to his dad to tell him what it was like to be at war. So, and it brought back a memory of mine, because we had a very similar reel-to-reel tape player when I was a little kid. And we made some recordings of my grandmother telling stories. And I wish I could find those tapes.
Those would be awesome. That's kind of like some of my relatives are old enough to remember when they were little, and these are relatives of mine who were in their 70s. I have no doubt that they're old enough to remember when they were little stories from Civil War veterans, and there were still quite a few of them in Mississippi at the time.
Well, I always look back and I mean, my grandmother was born in 1899, so she was 3 years old when the Wright brothers first flew, and she was 21 when women got the right to vote. So, fascinating journey through a very interesting time, and unfortunately, it's not recorded for posterity.
The loss.
But the good thing is, our children can listen to us sometime down the road.
After the steels have been lifted from their eyes and they realize how brilliant we really were.
Exactly. Because as
More likely when they wake up after they've finally gotten all the sleep they can possibly get and they find themselves bored.
Or if they really feel like they need something to put them back to sleep again. anyway. But
as long as we're of use to someone.
Well, you know, what can I say? I think that we're trying to share some information with the world that is useful. This nuclear stuff is just, people are just now relearning things that they knew back in the 50s before they had 30 years.
Their minds were poisoned.
Well, 30 years worth of a very organized, dedicated effort to make us afraid of producing power with a perfectly natural method of breaking apart uranium. And we were even taught that there's something unnatural about fission. And as you and I have talked about, you know, fission existed on this earth long before humans did.
Yep. And it may yet be going on in the center of the earth as we speak.
That's going to be a topic for another show.
Absolutely.
Well, I think it's about time for me to wrap up because I was actually on another talk earlier this evening with Cameron Riley and Richard Giles on the G'day World podcast. And my voice is starting to crack, so all of you out there...
Good place to stop it, then.
I hope you all have a great week, and keep reading the newspaper and hearing about how rich the uranium miners are getting, and think about how you might profit from the second atomic age.
Absolutely. So... bidding you good night, this is Shane Brown.
And Rod Adams. And this was Atomic Show number 9. Bye.
You're listening to the podcast network. Listen, learn, evolve.